Junkions, because it's time for another high-kicking episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend, my co-host, Lieutenant of Megaforce,
Cobra Kai.
The Johnny to my Cobra Kai, Mr. C. Robert Cargill. The C actually,
the leg, Johnny.
The C in C. Robert Cargill stands for Cobra. I don't know if people knew that, but it's true. It's a verifiable fact.
There is no humor in this dojo.
There is no humor in this dojo. Shame does not exist in this dojo. Movie face, you deserve no mercy.
You know what exists in this dojo?
What does?
Lots of Peter Cetera.
Lots and lots
so
of
much Peter Cetera in this dojo.
Hey,
oh
guys.
My God, Peter Cetera in this dojo.
Today, it's very clear as we're podcasting here that there's so many things we want to say. We will always love this movie. We would never let this movie be left alone.
I am the man who will podcast for your honor.
But more on that in just a moment. If you would like to hear us podcast for your honor, as we've done countless times before, you can access our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you want to give back to the show and help us keep the lights on here, help us keep sweeping legs and taking names, please go to patreon.com/ Junk Food Cinema. We will kick you guys some bonus podcasts only the patrons get to hear in return for your support. And then if we reach our $300 per episode goal, which we are not very far away from, we will introduce a new patron exclusive show where you guys get to send whatever movie you want to me and I have to watch and review it. And I've already seen some comments from our patrons saying that if we hit that level, here's what they're going to send me. And oh my God, I am in so much trouble.
Oh, you're in a lot of trouble. This was not a good idea.
It was a terrible idea.
In the world of terrible ideas, this was the terriblest.
You know what wasn't a terrible idea, Cargill?
Karate Kid Part 2.
Making a sequel to the goddamn Karate Kid. That's what.
Miyagi discovered the man within the boy. Now Daniel must discover the man within himself.
In Okinawa, I'm very serious.
No more tournaments. No more cheering crowds. This time, the combat is real. Karate Kid Part 2.
For those of you playing along at the home game, we wrapped up Summer of 86 last year.
We're technically done with Summer of 86.
But we're not, because we called an audible at the last minute. As we said, we were trying to figure out what the movie was, and we were going to figure it out. And we found the movie. We were going to do it. It's not streaming anywhere. It's not on YouTube. It's literally a movie where we would go, hey, everybody, Cargill was like one of the 12 people to buy this on DVD when it came out, and we have it, and we're going to tell you all about this super awesome movie that you can't watch. And then we're like,
even for us, it felt a little esoteric.
It was a little, yeah, like Russian, super awesome Russian barbarian film.
Yeah.
We'll at a later date, hopefully it'll get re-released, it'll be on VOD, it'll be streaming somewhere at some point, and we'll cover, for those, there's like three people out there going, they want to talk about Wolfhound. Yes, we fucking do.
Yes.
However, since we can't really find Wolfhound for you, we decided, we were like, what are we going to do? And I was like, oh my God, I just remembered, we never got around to Karate Kid 2. And I was like, Brian, let me be the man who will fight for your honor. I'll be the hero you've been dreaming of.
Yes.
And he's like, hell yes. And
yeah.
And here we are.
And this is going to be a very interesting episode, because what sold me on the idea of doing this movie is, one, it's absolutely a 1986 summer title we should talk about. Two, that song in and of itself on that soundtrack, absolutely want to talk about
it's
that.
It's a meme all its own.
So we backed off from being too esoteric to be more Peter Cetera-ic, as it turns out. And but the thing is, I remember Karate Kid 2 being good. Like, I remember liking it as a kid, and this franchise is one I watched a lot, but it wasn't the one I watched the most.
No, it was that one that you remember as good, but kind of like goofy.
But you remember it as an outlier because of the setting. And in my head, that was why it was so different. It was just, oh, they're in Japan, right? They're like the Bad News Bears before them, Daniel LaRusso goes to Japan. But that's what I didn't remember, because I spent way too much of my youth watching the goddamn third one, which is not good.
And some of us saw the fourth one twice in a theater.
Oh, wow, yeah. Then there's also the fourth one, should be the end of that story.
Whoa. Let's just say, for those of us of a certain age, Hilary Swank.
It was a little swanky.
Plus
swanky
Karate
good time.
Kid yeah. was kind of like, it's like, wow, it's one of my favorite franchises, plus one of the most beautiful women on the planet. Yes, why would I not want to watch this? And yes, I saw it twice. Fuck you.
Of course you did. Of course you did.
Because fuck yeah, that's why. Because Hilary Swank is fucking awesome and was a badass Karate Kid.
Well, to be fair, in all deference to you, I saw Karate Kid 3 10 times, which means I've seen Karate Kid 20 times, if you do the math correctly.
There's only one Karate Kid that has Shaolin bowling.
That's true.
Saying.
That's
and,
true.
And that also happens to be the one starring a 2-time Oscar winner.
Pat Morita won 2 Oscars? That's amazing. Fucking deserved them. Absolutely. One for Collision Course, I can only assume.
Why would Pat Morita not deserve all the Oscars?
I figure one of them is definitely for Collision Course, and the other one probably somehow for Happy Days, we don't know. But what I didn't remember about Karate Kid 2, and what was so amazing, and I feel like you had the exact same experience, is rewatching Karate Kid 2 and realizing it's the best movie in the franchise.
It really is. It is the significantly
Holy
better film.
Shit, this. Okay, so quick rundown of the plot here. So Daniel LaRusso and Mr. Miyagi.
Hold on. Before we get to the quick rundown of the plot.
Before we're even running down the plot.
Before we're running down the plot,
Act
we have
zero.
A 10-minute run of the greatest hits of Karate
okay,
Kid.
That does not change the first three movies. The beginning of each sequel, 2 and 3, is like, last week on Karate Kid, and it's the same fucking week.
And they pepper in a few new scenes with old scenes.
Well, new takes, really, more than anything else. Yeah. And they bring back John Kreese, the leader of the Cobra Kai, to do one scene at the end of this movie, which apparently was in the script for the first one, but they never shot it. So they bring back Martin Cove as Kreese just so that he can prove to yet again be a total asshat, this time beating up
his own student,
William Zatka, Johnny Karate, for losing the All-Valley Tournament, and then Mr. Miyagi intervenes. And what you don't know watching that scene is that's going to set up the third one. So put a pin in that because we're coming back to it. Apparently, what happens after the All-Valley Tournament is the nexus of the Karate Kid universe.
Yes.
So many things happen as a result of that point in time.
You know what? I don't think the Karate Kid series gets enough credit for how well structured and tied together it is.
That's true.
Like, it's like really it does have its own story that it tells over the course of 4 movies that don't ever like it's never one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, we ran out of ideas and it's Karate Kid. Even next Karate Kid has these lingering things from the early Karate Kid series.
Yeah.
So and it makes sense in its own I'm going to slightly apologize for loving it way.
Yeah. But it's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe or the MCU if the M stood for marginal martial arts.
Yes. But so we open up with 10 minutes of the first movie.
Reminding you of so much.
It's all your favorite moments. Like, literally.
Hey, kids, remember Karate Kid? It came out 2 years ago.
If you kind of wanted to watch a 2.5-hour movie in 10 minutes, that's kind of the way to do it. Like, it's like, what do you remember? If I were to ask you, what do you remember from Karate Kid? You'd be like, okay, well, there's the part where they're all dressed up as the skeletons and beating up. Yes, that's in there.
Yep.
Well, then
it's in there.
Then there's, sweep the leg, jog, Johnny, sweep the leg. Yep, that's in there.
It's in there.
Then there's, there is no mercy. Show no mercy. No, that's in there.
It's in there.
And
get him a body bag. It's in there.
And the crane kick. Yep, it's there. Like, it's all, like, all the greatest hits are right there.
Yeah.
We're back. We're all caught up with Karate Kid. Another interesting sidebar to mention is how long these movies are and how you never notice how long they are while you're watching. The original Karate Kid's 2.5 fucking hours long.
Yeah, that's true.
This one, the sequel, is significantly shorter by being 2 hours long. It's
a scant 2 hours you spend.
These movies are typically 85, 90 minutes max.
Yeah.
And they are a brisk fucking 2 and 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And they never spin their wheels.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really interesting how they pull that off. Everyone forgets how long the original Karate Kid is. When they re-released Karate Kid, or remade Karate Kid, rather, all the critics were bitching. They're like, oh my God, this movie's 2.5 hours long. How do you make a 2.5-hour Karate Kid? And those of us that fucking knew Karate Kid were like, motherfucker, that was the original thing.
Because they've already done it.
It's like, oh yeah, shit. Yeah, it was a long, and they pull out their phones. Oh yeah, okay.
Whoops.
Sorry. But yeah, so So here we go. So 2.5 hour movie compressed into 10 minutes. Bam. Now we're in the parking lot and we're ready to run down the plot.
And you know what other franchise does that exact same thing I just realized is the fucking Rocky franchise, because the beginning of every Rocky movie is a rundown of what happened. Ironically, the director of Karate Kid and Karate Kid Part 2 is John G. Avildsen, who also directed a movie called Rocky.
And who does the music for these? Bill Conti.
Bill Conti, that's correct. I was like, I knew it was somebody good. And, so, and I was listening
not
to...
Not just somebody good.
Yeah, it's somebody... the guy who did the music for Rocky. Yes, I know. But it's funny, too, because listening to this movie, like hearing the... There's some really dramatic... heavy stuff in that score.
Oh yeah,
that is beautiful to listen to, and you will sit there going, why is this in Karate Kid 2? Seems like it should be in something way better than this, but
except that Karate Kid 2 is a super super subtle film that's saying a lot without directly saying it.
Yeah.
And we're gonna go into that, because like really it's watching it when you're young, you don't fully comprehend what's going on in this movie. And it really is one of those movies that ages with you in a way that we were not expecting.
That's true. That is very true. And here's... So the basic plot of The Karate Kid 2 is that after the All-Valley Tournament, it takes place 6 months after that. And it's so funny because you have that moment right after with John Kreese and the whole humiliation there, and then it's like 6 months later, which, if you didn't know where the sequels were going, would seem kind of like, why bother to have that in there? But then, of course, it sets up both 2 and 3. But 6 months later, Miyagi gets a letter saying that his father is dying.
Oh, hold up. Before the letter, we need to address the...
Address the letter.
We're just going to throw Elizabeth Shue under the bus.
No, not just under the bus, but off the bus while it's moving and no one's looking to run under the tires.
Like, the first time we meet Daniel again after the tournament, he's driving up in his car. His car is fucked up. We find out that Elizabeth Shue had run it into something.
Yeah.
And then went and told him that she'd fallen in love with some college football player.
Right.
And this is the last we're ever going to mention her.
Well, and this is like, it becomes a running theme with Daniel LaRusso at the beginning of each new movie. It's like, whoa, what's going on with your girlfriend? No, she's... she ran off with a football player, or she got this great gig in Okinawa and decided not to come over. Like, they get rid of these love interests so fast. But in this case, you gotta commend Elizabeth Shue. She didn't come back because she had resumed studies at Harvard. And it's like, yeah, I can't fault Elizabeth Shue for seeking her Harvard degree instead of doing Karate Kid 2.
And ultimately having a storied career as an Academy-nominated actress. In fact, didn't Elizabeth Shue win that year?
For Leaving Las Vegas?
Yeah.
I believe so. I want to say she did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's kind of fucking awesome and went on to do amazing things. So, okay, you didn't show up in the second one. And instead, we get a really sweet romantic story here.
Yes.
Although, maybe... The subtext of this is that Daniel LaRusso is just kind of a shitty fucking boyfriend who's really good at wooing women and not good at keeping them. So they keep running off and finding their own excuses. Oh. And he's just kind of like bitter about it. Like, oh, what? She falls out. I fell in love with some other guy. Fucking bitch. And it's like, oh, wait, no. You are a one trick pony. Like, you always.
You're a one trick pony boy.
You're a one trick pony boy. Oh, God. Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. One trick pony boy.
Oh, you were waiting for that, weren't you?
No, I hadn't even thought about putting those two things together until you said
because
that.
Because the
so
end of every Karate Kid movie with him is him using the one trick that he learned to win the fight.
So true. Like, it's so true.
Yeah. It's in the first one, we have the crane kick. The second one, we have the drum. And it's always like, use your special trick. Use the Rachmaninoff move.
Miyagi teach Deus Ex Machina technique.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... That is exactly what it is. It's like cutting edge with, where it's like, use the foot. No, it's forbidden.
So use the other thing I teach you.
Yeah,
this thing that you don't think is important to karate that turns out to be really fucking important to karate.
So Daniel LaRusso is a one-trick pony boy.
One-trick pony boy accompanies Miyagi to Okinawa so that, which, by the way, he hasn't, Miyagi has not been back to Okinawa since he was 18 because while he was there, he fell in love with a woman named Yuki who was arranged to marry his best friend Sato, who was the richest man in the village. And basically what had happened is that Miyagi's father was the person who taught karate in this village in Okinawa, and he taught only to family, except that Miyagi convinced him to also teach Sato. And Sato felt dishonored by the fact that the woman who was arranged to be married to him had fallen in love with Miyagi. He felt betrayed by Miyagi and challenged him, his honor besmirched, to a fight to the death.
Yeah, because Miyagi actually was kind of a dick. They were betrothed. They fell in, you know, he fell in love with her. She fell in love with him, to be fair.
True.
He stood up in front of the whole town and said, I love this woman and I stand against this marriage, humiliating his friend. And his friend is like, all right, we got to fight to the death.
No domo arigato from Mr. Sato. He, in fact, challenges him to a fight to the death. But rather than fight, Miyagi leaves the country because he doesn't believe in fighting. And I think what's interesting about that is what he's saying is he doesn't believe in killing, is really what he's saying throughout this movie, because we've seen him fight when necessary. He does,
well, the thing is you learn it's on the dojo wall, you know, karate only for defense.
Yes, which is rule one, and rule two, see rule one.
Yeah, see, rule two is actually go back and see rule one. So that is, but yeah, but that's the brilliant subtext of this movie. They never actually say it, but what they convey through the storytelling of what happens to this whole movie is that Miyagi didn't leave because he was scared.
No.
And Miyagi didn't leave because he was told it was only for self-defense, because technically he would have been defending himself. Miyagi left because he knew he would kill his best friend. After humiliating him. And he would rather be dishonored and live without the woman he loved than murder his best friend because his best friend felt he needed honor. And it is conveyed brilliantly between these two different scenes that we will get to here as we continue in the story.
And then accompanying him like extra baggage is Ralph Macchio, Daniel LaRusso. Here is my favorite part, my favorite fucking part of Karate Kid 2. It is the Mr. Miyagi show. This movie should have been called Old Karate Man and not Karate Kid, because the thing that bothers me the most about the first Karate Kid, I'll say it straight up, I don't like Daniel LaRusso. I think he is a whiny, just awkward, like, he's not a hero that it's easy for me to rally behind until he starts getting his ass kicked by the Cobra Kai.
Have you ever seen the Community episode about Karate Kid?
Probably, because I've seen most of the Community episodes, this but I can't
the,
remember.
It's the one where where Annie and Chang get the roles of in the starring roles in the Karate Kid. Annie is playing Daniel LaRusso and Chang is playing Mr. Miyagi. And the director is like loving everything that Annie's doing, like just mm-hmm. loving it, and is busting Chang's balls left and right. Chang cannot get anything right. And they're like, everybody starts kind of trying to figure out how to tell this director, hey, lay off Chang. And finally Annie gets the balls to do it and says, you know what, if you're gonna treat Chang that way, I quit. And he goes, all right, bye. And he's like, wait, why? Well, bye, I'm the star of the show, I'm the Karate Kid. He's like, the Karate Kid isn't the star of the Karate Kid. The Karate Kid is about Mr. Miyagi. And what the whole big thing was, he was pushing Chang because he believed that Chang had this one brilliant performance in him mm-hmm. and was pulling out this brilliant performance as Mr. Miyagi, and lays out this whole thing about how the whole story of the Karate Kid is really about Mr. Miyagi, and he's the soul of the Karate Kid movies, that Daniel LaRusso can be anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just the everyman that's put in there. Like, he has no flavor. He's got nothing. He's just a kid who's really good at getting his ass whooped until the last scene. But the movie is always about the soul. The movies are about the soul of Mr. Miyagi.
I mean, that may be true, but it's not until the second one where that's allowed to play out in epic, classic Japanese drama form. I mean, yes. This is a fucking Kurosawa film masquerading as a Karate Kid
literally.
Sequel. Yeah, it
literally.
Absolutely.
It is a samurai movie.
Yeah,
it is.
The old Ronin coming back to his village after many years and trying to decide whether he must engage in the blood feud with his former best friend. Like, the heavy, heavy, like, not only subtext, but just the themes at play here are so interesting.
It's, you know what it also is? It's Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it is. The past comes back to haunt him in a way that he doesn't expect. An old flame is brought to life. An old enemy comes in, and the enemy is unrelenting, and he does not want to fight him. There are much bigger things at stake. He's got to, you know, his father is sick and dying. He's reconnecting with the woman he loved that waited for him to come back for 40 years. And here is this unrelenting enemy that is just going nuts on him and will not stop.
Yeah.
And it just, and then there's a point in the third act that we'll talk about soon in which it veers off from Wrath of Khan, but structurally it like hits all those Wrath of Khan notes. Like it is like Miyagi and Daniel are just getting, you know, crucified by these guys, and they get small little victories only to get their asses handed to them again.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the complaint with sequels all the time you hear it, is that they're just rehashes of the first one. They just do the first one again. Yeah. They just follow the same exact structure. You cannot, in good conscience, with a straight face, tell me that Karate Kid 2 is just a replay of the first one again. If you want to say that about 3, that's fine, because it is.
Yes.
But the second one goes off in its own direction and does its own thing, establishing its own identity, and then almost as an afterthought in the third act goes, oh, yeah, I guess we need something that involves LaRusso more, because, frankly, you could, up until the very last scene of this movie, you could cut Daniel LaRusso completely out and be fine.
Yeah.
Because he is on the periphery of this movie in a way that I'm fine with, because fucking Ralph Macchio's little, like, he drifts through every scene dropping jokes like he's an observational comic from the late 80s. Like, he should be wearing shoulder pads and standing in front of a brick wall, because it's always like, oh, hey, people going through my bag at the airport. I'm glad I had clean laundry. It's like, he's,
what's
like,
what's that about?
Andrew Dice Karate is basically what he's doing. Ooh. And it fucking drives me up the wall the entire time. And he did it in the first one, too. But the first one, he was more insufferable to me because he was complaining about having to leave New Jersey for sunny California. And
now,
offense to New Jersey, but you've got to be fucking kidding me complaining about that.
He's like, I got to go to Fresno.
Oh, I got to go to Fresno. I'm like, oh, fuck you so hard, kid.
Yeah, but see, but that's the, but that what's wonderful about it is that it really does allow us to show how great a teacher Mr. Miyagi is.
Yeah.
Because he's slowly teaching Daniel LaRusso how to actually be a man. And in the first film is all about him standing up for himself.
Yeah.
This movie is entirely about what it means to be honorable.
True.
That's what the whole movie is about. It is not about standing up and beating the bullies. Like, in fact, there is a whole bully storyline that gets fucked into oblivion as a result of honor. Like, it is, and it's so good how that plays out. But this is a movie that is all about teaching Daniel-san what honor is and showing him what true honor is. Because that's the thing, is you learn that Miyagi's whole life has been suffering because of how honorable he is.
And the other crazy Kurosawan element of this movie is the classism of the film. And the idea that basically Sato has gotten to a point where he's accumulated so much wealth that he's bought Miyagi's village, and he is making these people suffer. Like, this is
they're farming on land they're renting from him.
Yeah.
And he's cheating them.
And he, not only is he cheating them, he bought like their local holy castle sanctuary and is selling off pieces of it to a museum, like literally selling off their heritage. Like, this is the Karate Kid meets the Bad Sleep Well.
Yeah.
Like, which is a crazy fucking thing to say, but that's, so there's so many deeper themes going on here that Daniel LaRusso is on the outside looking in, and you can view this movie more as a teaching experience, not in martial arts, but there's so many moments in this movie that I love where Mr. Miyagi says something really profound that has to do with his personal struggle, because he's coming back, he's falling in love with this woman again, and he's being challenged every other hour by Sato, like, okay, we fight now. We're like, we will settle this now.
Okay, you know what? Your dad just died. I'll give you 3 days because he was our master, but at the end of 3 days, I'm coming back. And then, oh, look, 3 days is barely up. I'm fucking kicking over your gardens. I'm fucking tearing down your dojo.
Yeah, because these are Japanese bullies, so they are much better people at heart than American bullies. The worst things they do are like, we're going to break your bonsai trees and smash up all your radishes. And it's like, yeah, you're different from the Cobra Kai for sure.
Yeah.
You're better people. I will give you that. Well, not better bullies, but you're better people.
Yeah, yeah. And that does come back in the storyline as well. Which is great. You know, my favorite thing with this is, my favorite moment with Sato is the moment when all this bullying has happened. He's got, just to fast forward through what happens, he and Daniel-san get caught up in tons and tons of bullying while while Daniel is falling in love with a young Japanese dancer
named Kimiko,
and Mr. Miyagi is reconnecting with the love of his life. And they're just trying to get through the death of Miyagi's father and trying to wrestle with the past, and Sato just won't leave him alone. And just bullying scene after bullying scene after bullying scene.
Oh, and don't worry, there is an analog younger bully as well, so that we have somebody for LaRusso to contend with.
And that's the thing, is it's the two masters are dueling, so the two students hate each other.
Yes, and the Japanese younger bully is named Chosen, which I thought was not accidental. Although what he should have done is chosen to pluck his unibrow, because, oh my God, through this whole movie, he looks positively Cro-Magnon, and it was making me laugh the entire time.
Except the moment he takes that shirt off, and there is that perfectly sculpted, holy shit, like Brad Pitt in Fight Club kind of sculpted
carved
body,
out of
where you're just like, that guy's gonna destroy fucking Daniel. Like that guy is just made of muscle with more muscle laid on top of it, and then sewn together with more muscle. Like there's just...
Why did you bother messing with John Cusack in Better Off Dead? You could have just been out scoring chicks left and right.
Why are you messing with this guy? Why are you even wearing shirts? Like, if I had that chest, I would be Corey Coleman. I would never wear a shirt again.
You should have been shirtless Howard Cosell that entire movie. That would have made a lot more sense. Come on, man.
No, but so we have, we've got all this bullying going on. Mr. Miyagi decides to extend an olive branch. He goes out to see Sato and to talk to Sato and work this all out. And when he sees Sato, who not only is the richest man in Okinawa, is also the most well-known karate teacher in Okinawa. And he's got this huge piece of fucking driftwood that he's got stone pillars built around. And he's sitting there trying to break it by chopping through it. Miyagi walks up and gives a little chuckle and goes, "Is this the one we found on the beach when we were kids?" And he just looks at him and nods. And you're like, holy shit, this guy, here's the metaphor. This guy's been trying to break this piece of wood for 40 years.
I was just going to say, I think that piece of wood is from a Pacific Red metaphor tree.
Yes, that is exactly what it is. So he's there trying to, and he still can't. And of course, Sato won't hear it. And Sato keeps, the things get worse. And finally, Sato shows up to destroy the village.
Yes, and he brings the bulldozers in. He's going to level it to the ground. He sold off the land. He's going to level it to the ground and force all these people out of their homes.
And Miyagi says, "You can't do this." He's like, "Yes, I can." He goes, "All right, I'll fight you. I'll do it. But the one stipulation is you give the deed over to the town, whether win or lose. These people get their town back." And so Sato's like, "Finally, took you long enough." And they go off, and he's like, "Midnight tonight, the shit is going down." And so Daniel pulls him aside, like, "You can't do this. You know, this guy's going to destroy you. You can't die. You know, we could just leave." And Mr. Miyagi says, "I've already won. Mm-hmm. No matter what happens to me, these people get their town back. They get their heritage back. And that's all that matters."
Yeah.
And like, you're like, holy shit, Mr. Miyagi, dear God. And so then, before everything is about to go down, like a few hours before, not like we're standing there and it all happens, it's literally, it's just starting to get dark, and this terrible typhoon comes in.
Yeah, it comes up almost out of nowhere in the middle of a very unnecessary tea service scene between Daniel and Kamiko. Oh my God, dude, you've got to be kidding me with that scene. That scene is in there because it's like, well, Daniel is still technically the Karate Kid and the star of the movie, so we've got to develop this love story a little bit so that he has a place in this film. But I was the whole time I'm just like, I want to go back to the Miyagi show. I'm way more interested in the Miyagi show.
Is much better, but the thing about the tea service is the scene where she is telling him, "I love you, but I can't say I love you because I am too shy and I am too, this is not our way. My way is to have this tea service. And if you respond in the right way at the tea service, you are telling me that you love me too."
Which apparently the right way is to, I don't know if this was a directing choice or just that Macchio's not the best actor, but he looks like he is getting sexually aroused by tea in a way that made me very uncomfortable. I was like, dude, I understand what you're going for. I don't think you're quite hitting it. I think you've gone past it, and you need to put it away, LaRusso. Just put it away, buddy. Put it in a body bag. Slide it away.
Stagro. At least it's not the 5 minute unnecessary oh my god scene from the same summer.
Oh, you could totally edit this tea service scene so that she's following all the customary
and
procedures.
John Stamos
and you just
is
cut
like
to John Stamos.
He's biting his fist.
Or like eating that apple furiously for whatever reason. Can you imagine like an edit where it's like her, but then you just cut to fucking John Stamos like him
like
and
all people would get that joke, but it would be fucking hilarious to those 12 of us.
There's your mission, Junkions. By the way, you're all called Junkions now because of Transformers, so
yeah,
congratulations.
So the storm comes in and everybody starts running for cover, and Sato's hut gets hit and collapses.
Yeah, because he's staying in the village just waiting for midnight when this feud is going to, this battle is going to go down.
Because this is the night he's been waiting 40 years for. He's not leaving. He's not going to let Miyagi pimp out of there.
Yeah.
He's going to wait there.
He's pitching a hut and waiting
it
out.
He's hanging out in a hut, and the hut collapses, and his number one student, Chosen,
his nephew, by the way.
His nephew runs in and gets it, you know, and Miyagi's like, "Where's Sato?" And it's like, "He's dead."
Yeah, he just thinks he's dead immediately.
Yeah, he's like, it's too late for him. And Miyagi's like, oh, that's not how this ends. And he runs over and he sees Sato, and Sato is under a large piece of wood.
Also from the Pacific Red metaphor tree.
It is a large piece of timber. And he's
being crushed by symbolism.
Well, but the beauty is just how they shoot it and how they build up to it. So he's pushing he's got the board right in front of him, and Sato's like, do it. You know you want to do it. It's the only way you can win this.
Yeah.
This is how you get your town back, and this is the only way you can win without honor. And then Miyagi punches, because the whole time you know what he was going to do. He punches, breaking that fucking thing in half like it's nothing, and then lifting it off Sato. And in that moment, not only does he save Sato's life, which Sato realizes, in that moment the unspoken look on his face is like, holy shit, you could have killed me this
whole
time.
You could have killed me 40 years ago.
You could have killed
me.
This is why you left.
Yeah.
You didn't want to kill me. And in that moment, Sato learns honor, and Khan becomes one of the good guys.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, he, from that moment on, he has this change of heart. And sure enough, Miyagi and Daniel carry him back, only to discover that there's one more girl in town out there stuck up in a tower, and the tower is slowly being blown apart. And Daniel's like, I gotta go, I gotta save her. So he runs out to save her, and Sato turns to Chosen and goes, go help him save her. And Chosen's just like, I'm not going out there.
Yeah, I can't do that.
And like, they have this moment, and sure enough, like, he won't do it. And Daniel goes out, saves the little girl, barely survives. You know, Sato goes out with Miyagi, pulls them both in, and they have saved the entire town. And there is this moment of kind of elated joy of like, oh my god, I can't believe this all happened. And it's a saccharine moment for nary a second before Sato turns to Chosen and says, from this moment on,
to you, I am
to
dead.
To you, I am dead.
Oh, I see.
Though, thus creating our psychopathic fucking bully for our final 5 minutes of the movie.
Because now our bad guy has had a change of heart. He comes in at the end
and an earned change of heart.
A very, very earned. I do not mean to make that sound like it was cheap. It was a very earned change of heart. He comes in, delivers the deed to the town, is helping everybody rebuild. Clearly, the hatchet has been buried between him and Miyagi. And then they have this dance where about halfway through the dance, the writer realized, oh, yeah, this is called The Karate Kid. So I guess better have Daniel do something.
They're having it's Yub Nub.
Yub Nub, yes, at the castle for the first time in years.
We're celebrating that everybody survived, that the bad guy had a change of heart.
Yes.
You know, it's essentially it's the Grinch. Change of heart. It's Ebenezer Scrooge. He's come to town. He's got the goose. Everything's great. We're throwing this great party in the sacred place that, you know, he's given back to the town. And then Chosen shows back up.
Chosen shows up and challenges LaRusso to a fight, which is, again, we're not talking about a tournament. We didn't know the movie was leading up to this. We thought the movie was leading up to the fight between Miyagi and Sato, but instead, they kind of pull this curve on us. And it's interesting, and here's why I don't think that, while it is clearly in the movie to just go, oh yeah, by the way, it's Karate Kid. It's also an interesting parallel to the first movie, where at the end of the first movie, you have a complete hard-ass piece of shit bully, Billy Zabka, who suddenly realizes the error of his ways and doesn't he's not hip to what Martin Kreese is selling anymore.
Yeah.
But Martin Kreese is still a psychotic
still
piece
like,
of shit.
You cheat to win this, and he's like, I don't need to cheat to beat this guy.
And then after, and that's why I think this scene is in Karate Kid 2, is because it sets up later that we have a reversal of that situation where now the master has had a change of heart and doesn't want to pursue evil ways anymore, but the student cannot be broken of that, and is because Chosen runs off after being told that, you know, you're dead to me, runs off, and still in Japanese is claiming he's going to kill Daniel LaRusso. He's not changed at all, and then he shows up to challenge him to this fight. And what I love about this fight is that this fight...
There's so much to love about this fight.
This fight ends with something that, you know, the first Karate Kid, like, there's some brutal moments in that fight, sure, but the crane, while iconic, is it's a little silly, and I love the fact that it doesn't work.
No, that's
in this fight.
That's my favorite part of this fight, is he's like, he looks over at Pat Morita and he's like, watch this shit, and he does the crane. You're like, he's doing the crane, mother. And I guarantee you, it's that scene that in 1986, everyone in the audience is like,
oh, here
it
comes.
He's doing the crane, motherfucker. He's doing it. He's doing the crane. Yeah. It's the crane, motherfucker. Watch. Here it is, the crane. And he goes to crane kick, and Chosen just goes, get that shit out of here.
It is
max it the fuck away.
It is WrestleMania 15 when the Rock spins out of the stunner, and you're like, what the fuck? That was supposed to be it. Come on.
Wow.
Yeah, I dropped a little wrestling. Cut. Yeah, you're welcome. Deep cut like a razor blade that Stone Cold hit in his wristband. Don't worry about it. But what then, after that, you get that moment where it's like, you get the moment where, again, like wrestling, he has to hear it from the crowd to get back up.
But before that, can we just point out that throughout this movie, even though it's called The Karate Kid, he's still not very good.
It's like he forgot that he knows. It's not just that he's not good at it. He forgets entirely that he knows how to do it. Like, there's so many moments where he just gets his ass kicked because it's like he's never heard of karate before.
It's kind of awkward.
There's a great scene where he's in a bar and they're like taking bets on who can break this ice. And there's all these like American GIs because there's an Air Force base nearby. And they're having trouble breaking all this ice. And LaRusso is standing there going, no, he's standing all wrong. You got to put your weight. You got to do this. And then the guy's like, oh, you think you can do better, Big Mouth? How about you do it? And he's like, immediately like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I'm like, you were just talking about the science of making this happen. You just won the goddamn All Valley Karate Tournament.
All Valley, motherfucker.
Yeah, the whole valley, not just one part of the valley, but I'm sure as far as Fresno, which you're so hesitant to go to, they know who you are. And then suddenly he's like, oh, I don't know if I can do karate. And he does the same thing when he's being taught about the drum method. And it's like, dude, you know Miyagi knows what he's doing. You know that it's going to come back and help you in the end. And sure enough, in that moment where like he's all of his charisma has gone down and he needs to get it back up before he can do his finishing move, the whole crowd starts doing the drum thing, which is hilarious to me because only Miyagi has told him what that represents. So the whole village is like, I don't know why this is helping, but I guess we'll all chime in and just move this drum back and forth and create all this noise. And then...
And Chosen conveniently waits...
Oh, he's catching his breath. It's exactly
he's
like...
He's catching his breath while Daniel figures out
dude,
what the drum method is.
Dude, this is WWF wrestling. He is, like, catching his breath and giving LaRusso a chance for the crowd to pump him back up so that he can do... And this is where I really give this fight credit, because I thought it would just be like, oh, he avoids, and then he kicks him. No, he uses the drum method to just beat the ever-living shit over
and
over.
There's this running thing throughout the entire movie that there is some subtle technique to this.
Yeah.
He realizes it's, oh, I punch with this arm, and then I punch with this arm, and then I punch with this arm, and I punch with this arm.
I double fist punch him this way, move this way so he can't hit me, and do it again, and pummel him, and they move in on LaRusso's face, and he's got like Van Damme and Bloodsport intensity all of a sudden, and I'm just like, I think he's gonna kill Chosen. I think he's gonna beat this man to death.
Which is exactly what they're going for. This guy has ruthlessly beat him up through the entire movie.
Yeah.
He's been a total prick, and then he just held a knife to his girlfriend's throat and then knocked her the fuck out.
Oh my god,
like, she came to help him, and Chosen just turns and fucking knocks her the fuck out. And then she has that moment where she comes to and she looks up and her face is like just, you see the fucking fist marks. Like, this movie's like, oh yeah, no, we're gonna, this guy is the worst of the worst. Like, this is, this guy makes Billy Zabka look, it really is neighborhood bully versus this guy's going to fucking kill you. And yeah, that's what's kind of cool is right before Daniel goes into the pit with this guy, Miyagi says, this isn't like the tournament. This is for real.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, he has that look on his face like, you're about to die.
Yeah, and for some reason, I'm just going to stand over here and watch with everybody else, which is a real interesting turn. It's not a tournament, and yet it's structured like a tournament because nobody else intervenes.
Well,
but at all.
To be fair, you know, it is that thing where Miyagi knows what Daniel's capable of and trusts in him and trusts in his ability to teach Daniel.
And he might be a little sick and tired of him at this point. So worst case scenario, he's rid of LaRue. No, that's probably not the case. But there is a great moment in that fight right after he's pummeled Chosen to a pulp. And then the other parallel to the coda from the first movie at the beginning of this film comes in where Daniel, by the way, Daniel, who's been cracking wise the whole time, like, oh, you know, I was absent the day they were handing out grace, you know, little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet or whatever the fuck he's talking about throughout the whole movie, suddenly drops this line, live or die, man. It's like, holy shit, he's setting him up for a fatality. What the fuck is going on? Live or die, man. He asks it as a question, and Chosen, being a badass, says die, like, I opt for death. And LaRusso just goes wrong and honks his nose like Miyagi did to Kreese. And I fucking cheered. I was like, that is perfect. Perfect fucking moment. And it just that's where the movie ends, because it's like, we've accomplished technically being a Karate Kid movie when what this really was is Akira Kurosawa's Miyagi, which is what it should have been called.
Yeah. And the thing is, Pat Morita is so fucking great.
So amazing in this movie.
For all the flaws that Ralph Macchio has in this film, you know, for his kind of lack of charisma, which feels authentic. And that is what works about these
legit
movies.
Dweeby.
Is
I'll
he's
give you that.
Trying. He seems like a kid who's trying really hard to be cool and just isn't. And his authenticity is what girls key in on and then for some reason leave him by the next movie.
Because he forgets how to do karate.
Which is just the thing about Daniel LaRusso. But man, is Pat Morita ever fucking great in this movie.
And you know what's a testament to how good he is in this movie is that he is in a very traditionally Japanese setting. And I don't know if maybe this is just the ignorant American in me, but I can't imagine a harder environment in which to be an actor, because it's a culture that doesn't allow for a lot of emoting. It's a culture that is very reserved. And especially when you start talking about classical themes of Japanese culture, like, you can't rely on big reactions. You can't rely on, you know, screaming or yelling. There's so much that's communicated in subtle movements and subtle,
side glances.
Like, I can't imagine how difficult that must be for an actor to, like, you know, that's one of the reasons that I've always, like, idolized Toshirô Mifune, is, like, I can't imagine how hard it must have been. I mean, and even with that, in a samurai movie, you have at least the occasional moments of screaming, of that, like, that kya kind of thing. And this is Miyagi at his most reserved and his most emotionally powerful at the same time. And it's beautiful. It is poetic to watch.
And then, of course, the one scene where Miyagi busts out karate and just goes nuts on the bullies.
Which I have to say, I got to commend Pat Morita on this, because if you watch the opening of this movie where they show you the clip show of Karate Kid 1, what you notice is that scene where he takes down all the skeletons, there's a lot of stunt double in that scene.
There's a lot of stunt double.
There's a lot of bad Asian mask on some dark-haired stunt double. And then in this movie, not a lick of it.
No, the camera's pulled back. You're watching Pat Morita kick the crap out of guys.
Yeah, so
like old school.
I think that's the other reason that the story drifts away from a major fight between Sato and Miyagi, because Pat Morita's doing his own fighting in this movie. And it obviously the themes of honor are running much deeper than simply combat, so that's another reason. But it is interesting to note that in this movie, Pat Morita is doing all of his own fighting.
Yeah.
So that's really like.
But I think it's essential for this movie to work.
Oh, agreed.
In order for that ending to be earned, you have to be ramping up to a fight you want to see, and then realize why you never wanted to see that fight.
Yeah.
Like, you've seen that Mr. Miyagi's a badass. You do not need to see Mr. Miyagi kill another human being.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't want to do that. And so watching him save another human being while proving to that guy, I could have fucking killed you all these years, is just kind of like the most pimp-tastic way to fucking end that grievance ever. And like when Sato rolls up the next day with his caravan of people to help repair the storm-blown city, there's this look of humility.
Yeah.
And this wonderful thing where he just begs forgiveness of Mr. Miyagi, and Mr. Miyagi's like, there's nothing to forgive.
Yeah.
Like, beautiful. It's just like, it's like, holy shit. Like, this is, it's over. Like, it's done. Like, these guys have, they have exchanged honor and all is right in the world.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
And it's so good. That stuff is so much better than watching Daniel kick the crap out of Chosen.
Or watching Daniel try to date Elizabeth Shue and try to make it through high school and try to make it through the dismal existence of living in sunny California. Stop complaining, you little shit. I'm sorry. I have a lot of lingering issues with Daniel LaRusso in the first,
you really do.
In the first Karate Kid. I don't like him. I rooted for Billy Zabka for a little bit of that movie. I'm just saying. And speaking of fighting for honor.
He's the Karate Kid.
He is, according to Barney Stinson, the Karate Kid. But speaking of fighting for honor, we cannot talk about this movie without talking about the amazing soundtrack featuring one Mr. Peter Cetera. For me, the voice of the 1980s, Peter Cetera.
Yeah, and Peter Cetera with Chicago.
Peter Cetera with Chicago. This song, Glory of Love, is not only one of the greatest songs of the 80s.
It's also one of the greatest sequels to one of the greatest songs of the 80s. Power of Love.
Oh, I guess... There's the power of love. There's the glory of love. But this song, you
all leading up to Love Shack.
All leading up to Love Shack.
All roads lead to Love Shack.
And then we were tin roof rusted, and we never spoke of it again. But the thing about this song is, it's a great montage song. So it is probably not surprising to learn that it was a song originally written for Rocky IV, and was rejected for Rocky IV, probably because they just didn't have room for it. Like, dude, we are full up. Have you seen the list of fucking... We have 9 montages in this movie.
There's
and
a
they
lot
all
of
already have songs. I don't know what to tell you. So instead...
You're the best around.
Not gonna have a game, you know. Yeah, it's like, how do you beat Joe Esposito? And how do you do that in a love song? That is the fucking triumph of this song, is that it had to contend with one of the most... like pump up, like get you psyched to fight, like action ballads with a love song, and I think it fucking trounces Joe Esposito.
Well, I mean, everybody knows Glory of Love. Like, I you know, when I several of my friends locally are like, so what are you guys doing this week? And I just said, let me just say, what would you say we were reviewing if I told you that I was the man who would fight for your honor? And several people at once start groaning. They're like, no, it's in my head. It's in my head. You can just hear it. Like, it's such an infectious earworm, and it's so good.
Oh, it's so fucking good.
I mean, it's just, and it's good in a popcorny, cheesy sort of way. Like, in, no, is it one of the greatest songs ever written? Oh, fuck no.
I disagree, but go on.
Yeah, but try not to sing along when it comes on in the movie.
You can't. You absolutely cannot. And I think it's funny, too, that it was written for a Rocky sequel, instead goes to a Karate Kid sequel directed by the director of the first fucking Rocky. Like, there's something very kismet about,
you know,
that.
I feel like we should see if we could have a screening of this at the Draft House, but make it a sing-along screening, where all it is we just sing along every time Glory of Love comes on.
Or every time it doesn't. You can sing Glory of Love through this whole movie and be just fine. You know,
except
what?
Except when Pat Morita is talking.
Oh yeah, you don't sing when Pat
Morita
is talking.
You do not sing over Pat Morita in this movie.
I would prefer
everything of him in this movie's great.
And that's what's great, too, about Daniel LaRusso in this movie, is that there's so many moments where he just looks at Miyagi, something he says that's very profound, or some action that he does that is very honorable, or the way that he loves this woman. And you can see it in Daniel LaRusso's face going, I am never going to be the man that Mr. Miyagi is. I am never going to be the caliber of human being that this man is, and I need to learn from him more than just martial arts. I need to take everything this man does to heart, and I don't think he ever got there, but I think it's, you have so many moments where the look on his face is just, holy shit, I've never contemplated something that deep in my life. And it's kind of remarkable. Like, I don't know if it was intentional. I don't know if that was like Ralph Macchio's intention, but those moments land because of the look on LaRusso's face.
But that's what, you know, going back to what I was talking about earlier and what was kind of the fun gimmick of that Community episode is Ralph Macchio is just the everyman here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's just the receptacle for us to put ourselves in for wish fulfillment. But all the great lessons of this series, the main character of this series, the most interesting person in the series, fucking Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah, that's true. It's very true. And I think it's funny.
In fact, Miyagi'd has become a verb.
Ooh, nice.
You can Miyagi someone.
I intend to every day of my life, if I'm lucky enough.
Well, Miyagi-ing someone is, of course, getting them to do one thing, and in doing so, they learn how to do something else. And they even make fun of that in this movie at the beginning. They have that great moment where he's teaching, you know, Daniel thinks, oh, this is another training exercise. I'm learning how to hammer nails in. And really, he's just got Daniel building the guest house.
Oh, instead he's Huck Finning him.
He's Huck Finning him.
He's
yeah.
totally fucking
he's
Huck Finning him.
He's got him building his own guest house that he's going to live in.
You know what? Throughout that first movie, before the All-Valley Tournament, I'm like, I think Mr. Miyagi is just a brilliant con artist who has found a way to solicit cheap labor from this kid by telling him it's martial arts training. Like, I thought he was Huck Finning him the whole time, and then it's like, okay, no, I see the value. I see the value now. But yeah, and you get to the ending of this movie, and you realize what it's really about. And what's surprising to me is that the writers of this movie wrestled with whether the story was going to be about Miyagi in Japan dealing with his long-standing honor issues or this conflict with his best friend, or if it was going to be about John Kreese's revenge. And they were split right down the middle.
Oh, wow.
And they ultimately decided to go with the former and then save the latter for Karate Kid 3. And I realized that in less capable hands, because the director of the first two did not direct the third one, in less capable hands, the only Karate Kid sequel we likely would have gotten would have been John Kreese's revenge story from 3, and that would have killed the franchise, and it would have just stopped. And instead, they did something really fascinating, really giving an actor who is already iconic from the first one the ability to prove how talented he is as a performer, not just as somebody who can look really badass standing around and taking guys down as they come at him one at a time, but instead is a really brilliant thespian, and you just like these really deep, rich themes and things that really make you feel. And yeah,
you know what this is? It's the Samurai Kid.
It's the Samurai Kid. Absolutely. Learn from Mr. Miyagi's Bushido, Daniel LaRusso.
Never put passion before principle, even if win, you lose.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing,
which is just playing Glory of Love on repeat for
yeah,
a week.
Just eat a big fucking basket of Glory of Love. Eat some Satara fries all day long. Now, actually, I was thinking about this, and this movie, being a sequel, you have to be very, very careful with sequels because it's really easy to do it wrong, and when you do it wrong, it's disastrous. And it made me, and then the setting, and what's junk food about Japan, and I thought about it, and I'm like, sushi. You have to be really fucking careful with where you buy your sushi, because if sushi is done wrong, it is fucking disastrous. But the flip side of that is sometimes it's done really right in places you didn't expect. I know that...
Calling that junk food, though.
Sushi? How is sushi not junk food?
It's raw fish and rice. It's about as fucking healthy as it gets.
This movie's good, so I'm going to give it, I'm going to call an audible, because this movie is so good
that it deserves sushi.
It is risen above the caliber of junk food, and it's just a damn good movie in its own right. So, yeah. And you know what? You don't even need to see the first one, because it's going to explain to you at the beginning of the film what happened, and then prepare you for a much better movie in the second one. It is definitely the best movie of the franchise. I think unequivocally the best movie of the franchise.
It's, thematically, it certainly is.
Oh, and, yeah, for sure.
And I think it's got some of the better plot elements, and I think the bullying is much more effective in the first one. I think some of the bullying here feels a little bit like we have to have these bullies bullying them.
My favorite is when they're just tearing up that radish field, and I'm like, really, guys?
You know what? It's kind of interesting, like, that's really kind of the most dickish thing they could have done. Instead of beating
yeah,
you up.
In context,
we're
sure.
going to waste all those hours of work and force you to do all this work again.
They depend on that money. And yeah, no, I get it. Thematically, it's heavy. But when you just watch a bunch of guys just like...
Take hose to a radish field.
Angrily take hose to a radish field, which is a sentence no one has ever spoken before and probably never will again.
Yeah. Except maybe on the set of Karate Kid 2.
And the set of Karate Kid 2.
Somebody said, really? You want me to take a hoe and rage on a radish field? All right.
All right. I mean, I guess if that's what we're going for.
Rocky.
You know what you're doing. You directed Rocky. And yeah,
he does.
Yeah. He directs, you know what? He directs the Rocky into this movie. He directs the Rocky. This is, like, I guess Karate Kid 1 is more Rocky-esque because you have the underdog who kind of rises up. But this movie is far more interesting and far more layered than that first Karate Kid movie. And again, it's the best of the series. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Hope you have enjoyed what we'll cross our fingers, but we'll say it again. The last movie of One Junkie Summer. I'm going to cross my fingers just because I don't know what's going to happen after Fantastic Fest. So.
Yeah, we don't know yet, but that is definitely our One Junkie Summer.
That is,
We may do a few episodes later this year wrapping up other 30th anniversary movies because there are a couple other from this year that I think are really worth visiting or revisiting. But I have an idea that I get to pitch to Brian tonight on October, November. So
ooh,
we'll see.
Goodness gracious, guys. So stay tuned for that. Thank you so much for listening. Please continue to follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. If you've already done those things, please tell your friends about us. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Look for our stuff on Stitcher. And if you really want to support the show, consider becoming a patron. patreon.com/Junk Food Cinema. All that bonus content just for you guys. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also like my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And actually, before we go, guys, late breaking thing. Sorry about this. Editing it in because I can do that. Word. We actually have a giveaway to talk about this week. And normally we don't do giveaways, but this one seemed right up our alley, perfect for you guys, and we are so excited to partner with Vestron Video, who is releasing a collector's edition Blu-ray of Chopping Mall.
Chopping Mall, guys.
Which, by the way,
fucking Chopping Mall.
A movie from the summer of 1986.
Fuck yeah, which we almost covered.
We almost covered.
Didn't make the cut.
Didn't quite make the cut, but this is a really fantastically weird little slasher film starring not only the lovely Barbara Crampton, but also featuring an appearance from one of our patron saints, Mr. Dick Miller. So this is an absolute must. If you are a fan.
I love that we're wrapping up the summer of 86 by giving away a nice little piece of 86.
Yeah, no, it feels very fitting. So yes, we have a Blu-ray copy of Chopping Mall. It's beautiful. They really have taken their time and done a great job with this, Vestron. So the way we're going to give this away, the first thing you do is follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and then we want you to tweet at us what your five favorite films were that we talked about during the summer of 1986 One Junkie Summer series. Just we'll pick somebody at random who does that, but just
and it includes anything, our base the base show or our Patreon
series. any of them. Just give us your top five your top five movies that we've covered from the summer of 86. Could be stuff you discovered because of us, or movies that you kind of rediscovered your love for, whatever the case may be. Just give us your top five, tweet that at us, make sure you're following us at Junk Food Cinema, and we will pick somebody at random and send you a copy of Chopping Mall. So definitely be on the lookout and definitely start tweeting at us now. And I want to close this show remembering this is both to wrap up One Junkie Summer and to remember the first Karate Kid. We're going to go out to some Banana Rama.